this time of us together. You know, it's funny how sometimes you don't catch something, and then all of a sudden, after many years of reading a passage, it clicks in your mind. God created everything after its kind, but he created us to be after his kind. Yeah, I just hadn't thought of it that way. But brilliant thoughts come every once in a while, slowly but surely. This evening I want to talk about two things. One is the promise that paleontology, that's geology plus the fossils, actually made to us. There was a promise that certain things were going to come out of this, and you would find general evolution writ in stone. And so I want to talk to that idea. And then the second one is to deal with the most difficult thing that we have to deal with, which is the age of the Earth. Not that we can't do it in a very simple statement, and that is, I'm pretty sure the Earth is even older than Roger. It is a very simple thing to deal with that way. But none of us were around at the beginning, and we know that the Earth is older than man's recorded history. And so we have those two concepts that we want to talk about. So let me just... Okay.
Is it on?
Huh?
Is it on the side?
Yeah. I'll change it over to on, but I'm sure that it's on. They handed it to me. I compliment them, and look what I got for it. I'm sorry. Anyway, the thing that I started talking about was the problem of students not understanding this concept between chemical general and special evolution. You know, not something that they would naturally see, because it's never presented to them that way. And so, as I said before, if you want to help, when you get ready to use the word evolution, figure out whether you are talking about chemical or general or special evolution, and put that word in front of the word evolution. Because they will not be accustomed to it, but to me it answers so much about what we're trying to talk about. The one thing that I've noticed in all biology books and geology books and so on is that when they talk about general evolution, they use special evolution or natural selection examples, with the implication that somehow you can just stack them up end to end to get general evolution. I don't think the Bible teaches that, but I do think that it teaches that there is some limited change. I think I mentioned it at some point. I don't know whether you all caught it, but this tern that lives in the Arctic, you find it all the way around the Earth. You find it all the way around the Arctic. And at the beginning of what we call a clone, wherever you want to start it, at the beginning of that, when you go around, they can interbreed, and they can interbreed, and then these two ends can't interbreed anymore. Now, by our artificial definition of species, that makes the last two the first and the last new species. And yet they are connected, and they can interbreed all the way around until they come back and meet themselves. So we put the term species out there. Now, I want to tell you that the term species is just as difficult for any scientist, any biologist, to deal with as the idea of kind, because it's very relative. They change it. You know, what was a species last year may be a genus next year, or it may just be lumped in with some other species entirely. I told you then in my own research, I had 51 species of these two genera of mosses, and I collected all. This is very unusual. I was able to collect what is called an isotype, which is part of the type specimen, and I got it for all 51 species. So no one had actually ever brought all of that together and looked at it together. And, you know, I'm sitting one holiday season, I'm sitting in my former professor's, thesis professor's office down at U of L. Darlene's with me. And I have this big chart, and I've gone through, and I've marked all of these things in what we would call a huge spreadsheet, you know, and I put down all the characteristics that were there and all the measurements that were taken. And I was so frustrated, and I said, Darlene, I do not see these differences. You know, these are all scientists, they're all published, but I don't see the differences. To which she replied, as an outsider to my field, maybe they aren't. Now, you may not grasp the difficulty of me grasping that, but when you have published material that has been vetted, it's very difficult to say you were wrong. Some people do that. They run these experiments over again, but we're talking about mosses that go back that were collected in the early 1800s. So it's like, I would never have thought to say that. And when she said that, almost immediately, I realized I had two species here and I had four species in this genus. So from 51, I went down to six. That particular division that I made stands today and has been validated by some of the molecular work by another person. And they asked me ahead of time, we want to do some molecular work on this, and this is what we think we found. And I said, well, that still fits with what I said. And so that's where we are today. And I'm proud of it, but mostly I'm proud of Darlene, because instead of whining at my whining, you know, when I was whining, she actually went on and said, you know, as an outsider, because I don't believe that any scientist would have challenged it that way, because I was challenging a lot of people's observations. So you say, how could that happen? Well, they had never seen one another's specimens. They find something and it doesn't fit this little Latin description that this person wrote, and so they make it a new species. And so within science, we have this problem among taxonomists and systematists that there are lumpers and there are splitters. So I would be put into the lumper thing, you know. I didn't split it. I brought it back together in bigger lumps, you know. So I'm not bothered by that. Someday somebody may find something that changes the way I arranged it, but so far that hasn't happened. So I did that in 1976, and honestly, if you're a rock group and you're still popular now, you're pretty special. I don't know whether you actually get my point there, but it's lasted a long time, and I'm proud of that. But it could be changed next week based on some whim in the way that we change how we look at things. So that's an important thing. You would not normally see this difference, but no one will see it if you don't use it. If you don't make the distinction, no one is going to make the distinction, because no one looks at it that way. So anyway, the second thing is the idea of understanding evidence and interpretation, and I've just given you an example of that. Everybody, if they can, is looking at the same evidence. I remember I went to another bryologist lab, and there's a very rare moss that grows up around Natural Bridge, Kentucky. And I would never have seen it because I'm red-green colorblind, and it's very red on the sporophyte, exceptionally red. And so I couldn't see that kind of thing. I simply can't see red until I'm like right on top of it. And it's particularly bad if it's mixed in with green, which the sort of moss is green, and then there was red in there. So I went to his office, and he was drawing this thing. Now, he's looking at it under the microscope, and he let me look at it under the microscope, his specimens. And I looked at his drawing, and I counted the number of cells out from the little ceta in the middle, like a midrib. And he hadn't drawn enough. I mean, he had drawn it wrong. I saw his specimen. Instead of four, there should have been seven rows of cells out. And he hadn't noticed that. And we're looking at the same specimen. you know, and he always would refer to me as a laboratory geek. Did I tell you about asking the kids in my class about after everybody came out with jump drives and I realized that I actually had three on a string around my neck? And so I have 100 students out there and I said, you know, does that make me a geek because I have three jump drives around my neck? This one guy shot his hand up from the back and he says, no, not unless they're all full. I thought that was really perceptive. So you've got to know the difference between chemical, general, and special evolution. And if you want to do something, how simple is it to start using those terms in front of the word evolution? That will be a great service to what I've tried to get people to do. The second thing is there's evidence. We can take it, select it, arrange it, we can interpret it, and you need to be aware that that's happening. Somebody was talking to me today, and I said, you know, once you start reading in the literature with this, you'll begin to see the distinctions between these things. And they said, I already have. They went back and they read some material, and it was very clear to them what kind of evolution was being talked about. So if you use the terms, it's going to do a great it's going to be a great help to all of this. Now, the thing about the fact that all of the stuff that we accept on faith, there just are things that are really difficult. I'm going to talk about one of them tonight, and yet just this week I received some information that I will actually have to go back and look at because it seems to be a very valid challenge to something that I have in my presentation. So, at one time, that would have bothered me. And I would have thought, well, probably should let them have a discount. I haven't asked for money for down here. I have not, so there's no discount involved. But the point here is I would have been upset that somehow I missed this. But then I realized that I am human. I don't know everything. I will never know everything. There will be pieces of information that will go past me. So when I find something that appears to contradict the way I have said it, I will go back and study it. Can you all live with that? You know, I know it cuts me out of ever having another meeting down here, but if you can live with that, I would appreciate it. Because it was rather comprehensive for David alone. Anyway, let's go on to what I'm going to talk about tonight. So we want to start about this. We have talked about this chart, and I hope now, after we've said it a number of times, because that's pretty much what it takes, that what you see up here is the kinds. We can't put a very specific edge on the kinds, but I believe they exist. I do not believe that the species are the kind. Now, up in northern Kentucky, they built an ark, okay? I'm not exactly sure who directed them. If it turns out to be God, I think I'll probably go up there. But the point is they built this huge ark that theoretically is the same size and will carry the same amount of animals. And it's really amazing because it's like a $350 million project. But what they have there is they have full-sized animals getting on the ark. So they've got full-sized elephants and giraffes, etc., two by two. And what did we figure out? What were the kinds? Well, you don't have to take adult animals, nor do you have to take two of every species. See my point? So this whole debate over whether all of it could be on there is kind of irrelevant because you don't have to take 1.5 million species. God had him take two of every kind so that that kind was represented when they landed. But it did not mean two of every species. So it cuts down the number significantly. The gene pool was put onto the ark. Did not have to be put on with adult organisms. It could have been two small organisms that walked in, that we didn't have to be full-grown creatures. But it never takes the miracle out of it. You can talk about baptism all you want, but you cannot remove the miracle of God cutting away the sins of our flesh. I can't do that by anything I do. And Noah could not do it by anything that he did. He had to trust in God's miraculous power to save him. And it's a miracle. It's a miracle. It's a miracle. I can't do that on my own. One time I heard about a preacher who was making some kind of point in his lessons about the ark and if it had not been made out of gopher wood. Obviously, he was talking about following God's will. And he said, you know, if it wasn't made out of gopher wood, it would have just sank. You know? So he's going out the door, and this little old lady grabs him and says, you know, you're wrong on that. And he said, what? She says, about it sinking. And he's looking at her really funny. And she says, it never would have floated, ever. Which I thought was a very perceptive thing on the part of that young lady. So if you look at the bottom of this, what you find is the idea of this part up here is everything that lives today. These are the kinds. But when you are a general evolutionist, you believe that somehow you can find some ancestral forms that all go back to this original. So you have non-life to life, and then that life evolving in a general sense up until you get to where you are today. So everybody's looking at this up here and at fossils, and the general evolutionist says it all goes back to one source. Now, I can tell you there's thousands of systematists that would tell you it does not have to be one source. In fact, the guy who is sort of the top botanist in the world, when he wrote his book on plant morphology, he said, to me, I cannot see the connection in plants that would take you back to a single source. He says there may be multiple sources, which is kind of what I believe, multiple gene pools that were put on the earth by God that we would call kinds. So we have these two things. The top one, you're not trying to take it all the way back to a single source. You know, it's the special theory. It's natural selection, and I believe in a supernatural creation. And general theorists actually believe that there was a natural creation and that all of it can be traced back to that single point. And that's the concept of paleontology. So the promise was made that paleontology, when we found fossils from that great big tree at the bottom, would just kind of write general evolution out in stone. You'd never have to worry about it again. So let's see how that went. Now, we've talked about the special theory. I'm not going to go back over that. We've talked about all the races. We've talked about the idea of species. We've talked about natural selection. We've talked about things evolving within a kind. By the word evolved, they can change within a kind genetically, and they may even become something different under different environmental circumstances. All right. And the general theory, though, that brings everything back from that inorganic, non-living source, one source. So we've got that down pretty well. Now, this is the kind of tree that is drawn. And I will have to tell you that from the photography standpoint and from the standpoint of design, I'm ashamed of what I've done with some of these pictures because I tried to make them all come together and they didn't. So I will show you and you will understand it. It's just I wanted them perfect. Now, not everybody understands that as loopy as I tend to be, when it comes to photography and design, I'm sort of a perfectionist. I'll sit there and work on a slide for an hour and a half trying to get it to be perfect. You know, so bear with me, because I'll stand up here totally ashamed, feeling bad about myself, while you all get the lesson. This is the kind of chart that is drawn for children and for young students in school. It's kind of a amoeba at the bottom and then this branching, totally connected chains that go up to represent where all the rest of the organisms that we know would be. Okay? And it's sort of chronological. It starts out at the bottom saying this is all there was. But there couldn't have been. Somebody asked me about that today, and I thought, well, I guess I didn't make that clear. But Anna was asking me about this thing about, well, where did the oxygen come from? And I don't think I got around to that. But the oxygen, and if you're a general evolutionist, you have to believe that in this environment that had no oxygen in it, that somehow you created some organism that was like an animal, like an amoeba, but not photosynthetic. And you would have also had to have had those that were photosynthetic, because those are the only ones who can put oxygen in the air. Everything else breathes oxygen. It has to have oxygen as part of its fuel pack to burn the things that it's eating. And quite honestly, as a biologist, I find this part of it complete fantasy, total fantasy, because it's like, you know, which came first? You know, you just, are you going to have the oxygen there, which is needed for it to come into existence, just so you can make oxygen? It's like one of those chicken or the egg things. And as was pointed out in the kids' class, you still are left with the chicken and the egg and the whole debate over that, which I thought was a very interesting addition to my thinking. So that's what they see, and this is what it's supposed to represent right here. Now, I know that you can't see this, and I've told you before, I'm not embarrassed about using the things that were in the books from which I studied, because this was a geology book. They talk about not the Precambrian, but the Cryptozoic. So what does the word Cryptozoic mean? Better step up, I'll fall asleep up here.
Is that Ice Age?
No. Look at the word, tell me what it means.
It's an enigma.
It's an enigma.
Mystery.
Wrapped in a mystery. Crypto means it's hidden. Okay? So cryptology is the idea of finding hidden meaning in different things. And a crypt is where we put a dead body, and it's hidden from sight. So the zoic is life, and crypto means it's hidden life. I think that's actually a much better definition of what they found. But this whole thing in the rocks is what we call the Precambrian. This is the Cambrian. And the thing that distinguishes it is that there are no fossils, none whatsoever. But when you get into Cambrian rocks, however you define all of this, there is this burst of life. Just, and everything except the chordates, the vertebrates, is actually represented at that time, full grown. So it doesn't go through something to become a worm or a cockroach or so on. It's there. It's in that layer. And so one of the great things was to search for fossils in the Precambrian. And if you look at that in the book, they will say, these are fossil bacteria from the Precambrian. They are fossilized single cells in the rock. And if you can see that as a living thing, then you will see that as a living thing. If you believe it's a living thing, then you will say it's a living thing. I don't see it myself. There's other things that can make perfectly round little circles in the rocks. So we have the Cambrian and the Precambrian. And I went back and I looked through all the literature myself on anything that could be represented as a Precambrian fossil. And so then this is that kind of almost to the one point kind of tree. But the reason that I like this one is because what do you see in those solid lines that I was showing you a minute ago? They're not branching out and they're not solid. You have a bunch of dotted lines in this. And so this is what has become known among general evolutionists and those of us who are both. Let me rephrase that, because that's going to come out wrong on the tape. Those of us who believe in natural selection, but we believe it was a supernatural creation, we all talk about this along with the general evolutionists. So the idea is that this particular era is 5/6 of the earth's rocks. It says it right there. And it says that they can't divide it up into anything like this for one reason. It doesn't have fossils. That's it. So the fossils in the rocks determine the way they view the rock's age and everything else. And this is before some of the other things that we found, like radioactive dating. But you find these levels, and then there's a group that shows up at a certain place, but then we have this big gap before it goes to the next group. All right? So this is what I want you to see. This is one that that Darlene tells me was very important to her. There's a difference between the special theory changes and the general theory changes. In the general theory, what it says is, if you have a major group right here, that major group can evolve into another major group, to another, to another, to another, all connected together. But what I'm arguing to you about this natural selection with change within limits is this. Within the gene pool of this particular group, it can change within limits. And in this one, it can change within limits and so on, depending on the pressures that the environment puts on it. So this is what you would look at, these kinds of changes in special theory, but these huge changes that go over a long period of time and go from one major group to the other, they're not actually, the transitional things are not there. And people in geology know this. They've known it for years and years and years, and we'll get to that in a minute. Now, if I honestly, we talked a little bit about what makes man different. And this one I love. I don't know that it was put in to support what I was saying, but it certainly is very simple. Most organisms eat, survive, reproduce, then they die. And only man comes out and says, what's this all about? Almost nobody will know what I'm saying when I say, what's it all about, Alfie? Anybody here know what I'm saying? Well, I'm right. Okay. Very few people would ever know. That's a famous movie. So eat, survive, reproduce, eat, survive, reproduce. And then humans have this ability to stop and reflect on what all of that means. No other organism, just humans. And so I love this particular cartoon. I don't think it was meant to be, I think it was meant to go the other direction, but I think it supports what I've been saying very well. So, now let's get to the evidence for paleontology. Up to this point, I have given you quotes from my textbooks written by general evolutionists to give you the evidence. But on this one, there wasn't any. I could not find a single quote that was just evidence and did not have some kind of general evolution wrapped around it. So I wrote it myself. Some rocks have fossils in them. I didn't know any simpler way to say it. Some rocks have fossils. But it is true, and this came out of a textbook, that most fossils, even though you find them in sedimentary rocks, things that have produced sediment within lakes and rivers and oceans, you know, stuff that's come down in floods and it builds up on the bottom. They are found also in these terrestrial deposits in a lake or a stream when organic matter builds up and dead animals build up in that. It will produce layers there. But not all rocks have fossils. So I want you to think about that chart. The length of that chart. Let's go back until I get there. That's the chart, and if you put all the rocks in a column, this chart would be 5 times longer down below the floor. So I want you to picture this now. This would be the rocks on the face of the earth. You would have 1/6, where is it? I've got it right in front of me. This is 5/6 of geologic time down here, and that's 1/6. So you'd have to have 5 more of these charts representing all of that that would be down below the floor, none of which would have fossils in it. So the vast majority of rocks don't have any fossils at all. just this one part up here, which does not transition from non-life to life. It just starts, big old pop, and everything's there except the chordates, right as soon as the cambrium starts. So there's a lot of things that really raise questions, and they raise questions in my mind, and I've not found answers from general evolutionists on those things, what the impact is that actually is true. So let's go back, and we'll move along a little faster now. So the promise of paleontology was that the history of life would cease to be a hypothesis, a guess, an educated guess, and some with inference, and it would become direct knowledge when you had fossils available. So what this thing is saying, that if you get into the fossils, you will see chemical evolution, special evolution, and general evolution. It will be written out in the fossils within the rocks. So that was the promise, all right? And that comes from a geologist right there, right out of a geology book. So that will show up, that exact same thing, in the rocks. But I've already shown you that in the other chart that there's all sorts of dotted lines where there are no fossils. And you cannot find any place where major groups are actually connected. And there's all sorts of ways that they try to get out of that, but it's really true. You can't find any intermediate or transitional fossils. And you'll be surprised in a minute to find out that Darwin believed that too. We do find fossils everywhere. We find layers of rock that have fossils, and then we have layers that don't have fossils, and then we go down to the Precambrium, and there are no fossils at all. And then in the Cambrian rocks, however you mark them, you have this burst of life. And that's kind of where the situation is today. So that's the Grand Canyon. I've only seen that once, and it was from the air. It was spectacular. There's that chart again. And I just want to say this, that the idea is that when sediments are laid down, so when, you know, the Amazon and the Mississippi and all the great rivers of the world run into the ocean, they run into this mass of water, and they slow down, and they drop their sediments and whatever's in those sediments. So you would expect in all of these sedimentary rocks, because that's the only ones that we have fossils in, that in all these sedimentary rocks, you would expect the oldest to be on the bottom. Does that make sense? The stuff that ran down there last year or 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago or what have you would be at the bottom, and the newest stuff would be on top. That's called the law of superposition. And it's pretty much like what happens with the newspapers in the garage. Do you know what a newspaper is, millennials? Just need to know. All right, so you got your newspapers. They come in every day. And you throw it in the corner of the garage because that's a safe place until you get rid of it. Then next year you go back. Next year you go back to the 365 things that you have stacked up there. So the newest ones would be on the top, and the very oldest one from last year would be on the bottom. That's called the law of superposition. And it's the same idea with sedimentary rock. The oldest should be on the bottom, and the youngest should be on the top. And so this is one place where I do want to tell you, I must go back and I must look at this new information that I've been given, because it seems solid, but I have not read the original sources, and I feel like I am bound to read the original sources, because what I say is kind of jives with what all the other geologists I've ever talked to told me. And then here's a list of 25 places where they say that a complete geologic column has been found. So I got to go back and research this. And I appreciate this. You know, sometimes you make your most important insights once you're challenged in a particular area, and then you learn something else. So for the person who gave that to me, I so appreciate it, and they know that I appreciate it. But I was not able to do that because I have not had time to do it, but I am going to do it. But here's what I was told, that the geologic time column is not found in any one place, and you're going to see the quotes on which I based that. So if a pile were to be made by using each geologic age, it would be at least 100 miles high. That's out of a geology book, okay? So you'd have all of this, and that part where there are fossils, if you brought them in, and there's this one missing here, and this one missing here, and then you fold them into the deck like that, you just kind of fold them in, you would get a pile of rock that was 100 miles deep. And then it should show the fossils in their proper sequence. But what you find out is that when they determine the sequence, they go by what they think the fossils were in the evolutionary process. So the fossils end up being the things that in circular reasoning come back and tell you how old the fossils were. Now again, we're dealing with the early stuff where they didn't have anything absolute. We'll talk about, quote, absolute dating methods later. Isn't that great, kids? We're going to talk about dating methods. Anyway, so these are old pictures out of an old book, but they serve the purpose. If you look at the crossed lines, you will see that there are so many places on the face of the earth. These are from the USGS, the US Geological Survey, and the Canadian Geological Survey. And what you find is that the rocks that are the oldest are on top of the rocks that are the youngest. And that was the whole purpose of showing this. It's true in the United States, and it is true in Canada. And so you start trying to figure out, how in the world can you get big, huge pieces of the oldest rock on top of the younger? And what it always is brought up is the idea of overthrust. It's hard for us to grasp the pressures in the crust of the earth. You know, it really is. But when you see what happens when they go over one another, and they do, like at the San Andreas Fault or the one in Kentucky that came up through western Kentucky, those things make massive changes. They create lakes. They create tremendous amount of damage. They're talking about the San Andreas Fault out in California, showing all sorts of signs that it is going to have an earthquake, huge earthquake. I don't know. I'm not out there. Should I care? But I am in Kentucky, and the last time on the New Madrid Fault, when that happened, it rang church bells in Boston. I mean, the power of that earthquake actually did that, and it created a lake called Real Foot Lake in western Kentucky. And it did a lot of damage, but not as much as it would do today because we have so many more people living everywhere. That's the same problem with tornadoes, right? The longest tornado run that I've ever found in literature is 1,200 miles long across the Midwest. But it went through a relatively uninhabited, you know, sparsely inhabited area, but it was a mile across. And it went for 1,200 miles. Now you can imagine what that would do if it went through New York City or if it went through St. Louis, right through the main city. So anyway, that most of that has to do with population that is a bit out of control. So in all of these, my whole point is that when you look at them, like in Switzerland, all of these older layers, I mean all of these younger layers, the older layers are on top of it. It flips them over. And that has to be explained because it's real. Now, I'm just going to keep moving on and I'll show you. This is from Dunbar's Outlines of Historical Geology book. It's an old book, but it basically represented every quote that I found from that period. Earth history isn't recorded in a single outcrop or even on one continent. The records from many different regions must be pieced together in their proper order until we have the composite sequence of events. So it's kind of like you don't find the whole deck anywhere, but you find pieces of it. And so you need to put it together so that you can see the composite of all the pieces. So this is like playing 52 card pickup with a blank deck. Let's just say you play 52 card pickup with a blank deck. You don't have to worry about what sequence you put it back together, do you? Now, some people, when they put the deck together, they put it together by suits, and they do it from one to the king, and I mean one to the ace, and some people put the ace first, and they go to the king, right? I mean, I don't know how you do it, but what that says is it's not the card that you're putting in sequence. It is what is on the card. And when you look at this, what you're really saying, and I have a lot of quotes about this from the historians, of historical geologists, you are actually putting those rock layers back together by the way you think the markings make it. In other words, if you think it, there was a general evolution until we came up with absolute dating methods, which I'm not going to skip over tonight, that you basically were putting it back on the basis of the fossils themselves. All right, now there are other markings in the rock, but the fossils are the main thing. And you may not have noticed it on that chart that I showed you, that general evolutionary chart, but that's what it said at the bottom. They'd have to be pieced together. That's what Dunbar is saying right here. They have to be pieced together. So my friend John Clark put this together, and I'm going to have to stand back and read it. We found a quote from a Barnes & Noble outline series for geology. Now, you know, may not know what that is, but what it means is that somebody took like 17 to 25 of the currently used geology books, and it summarized all of the concepts into one outline book to study from. And it showed the pages where these things were for students. So it was like a study book for students in geology. We have them today. I know we still have them, but I don't know who makes them. It's not Barnes & Noble. And so here's the quote. First of all, you'd have to accept general evolution as a fact. To the geologist, evolution, general evolution, is a fact. It's not a theory, but not all of the causes of general evolution are known. And you have to use the fossils. Without fossils, Zumberg said, the details of geologic history could never have been pieced together. That's that word again. Constantly in these books, I found the words pieced together for the geologic sequence. Then you have to apply what's called the doctrine of uniformitarianism. Now, I'm going to read this, and then I'll explain it really simply. Detailed study of sedimentary rocks. Why did they keep doing sedimentary rocks? Why don't they do metamorphic rocks? Does anybody know what a metamorphic rock is? What's an igneous rock? Out of a volcano, right? So what's a metamorphic rock? Well, the forces in the earth squeezing on sedimentary rocks can bend them. So you can get waves like this. And it puts such pressure on them that it changes from clay or silt or sand, and it becomes something other than that, and it destroys all the fossils. It is the heat of that compression that destroys it. All right, so that's the idea of why we're only finding sedimentary rock here. So you have this kind of detailed study of these sedimentary rocks to provide clues to their origin. And by applying the doctrine of uniformitarianism, geologists can reconstruct the general relationships between source areas and areas of deposition during past geologic ages. So that's kind of like, and you don't know what I'm saying. So let me say it in a simpler way. If you look at the fossils and you apply this doctrine of uniformitarianism, which basically says there were never massive changes over a short period of time specifically aimed at the Genesis flood. It's always been little tiny small changes over a long period of time. And that is something that has distinguished the field of geology, but which geologists have tried to get out of. They've had whole symposia on trying to not use uniformitarianism anymore because it wasn't fitting what they had, but they were afraid that people would go back to this idea of an abrupt creation, some massive changes over a short period of time. So that's still up in the air. But what you have here is three things. You have the idea of accepting general evolution on the front end of it. and then using the fossils and piecing it together. And you piece it together on the basis of the fossils, not actually their time. And that's the way it was originally put together. And the detailed study of these rocks, and assuming, you're making an assumption, that it has always been small changes over a very long time. And that's the whole concept of general evolution. Small genetic changes over a very long period of time. So, this doesn't exist. Yet, I have to trace down these 25 things, and I really appreciate this more than you can possibly know, and probably more than my friend recognizes. But I'll trace it down, and I'll see what I find, and if I see something different, because every one of these other geologists over the years has said it doesn't exist. And you have to, you never get it on one continent, you have to bring them together and piece them together. And just like the cards in the deck, you really cannot piece them together until you explain what your assumption is about the way you're laying them out. If you're going to do it, if you're just going to pick them up, slam them all together, that's different from the idea of putting them in a particular order based on what markings are on those cards. So we've seen that, and Darwin actually knew about this. He knew that there was this absence of life in the Precambrian, and he also knew that there was this absence of intermediate forms and fossils. There were dotted lines, and there were none down here. Does that make sense? None in the Precambrian, and no dotted lines in some places. So there were these intermediate gaps. And that's what most of us are still talking about today on both sides of this issue. So this, by the way, is one of the micrographs of a sliver of a rock where they are saying that, this thing that you can see is a microscopic fossil. Maybe, maybe not. There's lots of things that can make that look that are not living. So that's about all that's been offered in terms of how life came into existence. Now, you don't need that. So he had those problems. He saw them in the geologic column. But his basic statement was, these are the two things we have not solved in general evolution, but they will be solved by finding further fossils. He had a great deal of faith in that. Unfortunately, it wasn't founded on anything good at all. It did not work out that way. Now, Niles Eldridge made this comment. He said, I admit that an awful lot of fantasy has gotten into the textbooks. Let me see, did I do it there? No. A lot of fantasy has gotten into the textbooks. He's from the American Museum of Natural History, a very celebrated biologist, geologist, paleontologist. Gotten into the textbooks as if it were true. For instance, the most famous example still on exhibit downstairs, that would be at the American Museum, is the exhibit on horse evolution prepared perhaps 50 years ago. And that has been presented as literal truth in textbook after textbook. And he says, now I think that is lamentable, particularly because the people who propose these kinds of stories themselves may be aware of the speculative nature of some of the stuff. But by the time it filters down to the textbooks, we've got it now as scientific truth, and we've got a problem. So that is a paleontologist talking about this problem. If you've ever seen that evolution of the horse thing, that's what he's talking about. When I was in New York City, I went to the American Museum of Natural History, and I looked for that exhibit, which was no longer there. They said it was under, they were refurbishing different sections, and that it was not up on exhibit anymore. I wanted to take my own picture. Got pictures of it, I just wanted to take my own picture. So then the next one that we got was from Stephen Jay Gould, who has now passed away. He was at Harvard. He was one of the most popular professors, but he was also the leading atheist in the country who was teaching this. And he says, the extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persist as the trade secret of paleontology. So this is not Darwin saying it. This is not people that lived long, long ago. This is somebody who was held up as the number one atheist and he was a paleontologist, and he says there's a trade secret in there, and that is that the evolutionary trees that adorn the textbooks have data only at the tips and the nodes of their branches, and the rest, see, now I changed that, and that's what did not show up. It says interference. Now, I meant inference. All right, so I fess up. I will come forward tonight, however a preacher comes forward, and I will repent of that. But I did change that last night, and it did not change. It didn't save in my thing. All right, so the rest is inference, however reasonable, not evidence from fossils or not evidence of fossils. And so he acknowledges the fact that these transitional forms are not there. He also is basically saying the fossils are really important because you have to have it supported by the fossil record itself. And it doesn't do that. And he got the book I told you about, Science and Creationism, from the National Academy. This is the one place where they have put in several pages trying to justify what he said without saying what he said. They are trying to explain it away. But the truth is, he told the truth. And it's sort of a trade secret that they don't have what they show you in the textbooks. Those trees, they don't exist. There are big gaps, and they don't know why. So what they do is they talk about a punctuated equilibrium. And I'm sure you know exactly what that means. It means somebody coming up and dumping you out of the swing on the front porch. You were in a nice equilibrium. You were nicely asleep. The point is, they don't have a clue. So they use big words, and I mean this respectfully. I think they use too big a words to explain something that they don't want to explain. They just bring another theory. And I ask many, many times when I first heard that, what is punctuated equilibrium? And they say, well, evolution just speeds up to warp speed there and it doesn't leave any fossils. Now, if you don't see that as a statement of faith, I don't think you're looking at it the way I am, at least. That's a way to cover something that doesn't fit. And it's something that has not been demonstrated by science, and that's what they're always putting their hope back in. So this is the tree. Now, Bolton David Heiser wrote a book about this, and Bolton David Heiser was a Christian. And so this is the second piece. And he had a series of 81 quotes. And every place where you see that tree disappearing, he had a quote from the expert on those groups that said, you cannot get this new group from that group. And so basically what we're doing is we're going down to the evidence. And the rest of that was what? Interpretation. So they may put it up this way, but this is actually the evidence. And that turns out to be interpretation. And those 81 quotes are still there in his book. And I found them amazing because he was not quoting creationist. He was quoting geologist, paleontologist, who said, I've studied this thing as my life work, and that is not going to happen. So I have to take things like that seriously because I'm not reading from the Creation Research Society or Answers in Genesis or anything like that. I'm looking at what general evolutionists, paleontologists, and scientists have said themselves. So this thing about the promise of paleontology just did not work out. And then somebody says, yeah, we have transitional fossils, Archaeopteryx. Can you say that with me? Archaeopteryx. Can you say it one more time now that you're awake? Archaeopteryx, right? Okay. Archaeopteryx is this bird that they say is a lizard, but it has feathers. And they have now put it in with the birds in taxonomy. They've just put it in there. So, Archaeopteryx, so let's talk about it. Of course, we find them all over the world. Well, not exactly. This is the one that we have. This is the one Archaeopteryx that we have. How big do you think Archaeopteryx was? Have you all had that in your classes? The flying reptile? Nobody in here? You have had it, haven't you? Does anybody else care? Don't answer the question. Anyway, that is Archaeopteryx. Many people think of it as having a 14-foot wingspan and things like that, but it's the size of a pigeon. So you have one squashed bird in the sediments that appears to have feathers on it, and the museums that have this particular specimen will not show anybody the other side of the crush. In other words, you should have a mirror image. You should have depressions over here for what you have here. And they won't show it to anybody. And that's completely documented, that they won't show it to anybody. So on the basis of this, they have said that birds came from reptiles. So I want to talk about that. There it is. You see its head, see its wings. And there are books that debunk it. So here's the way I do it. I pretend like, okay, that's fine. Let's say that is a fact, that there's this transitional fossil that people think they see between lizards and birds. Okay, reptiles and birds. But let's talk about how that would have to happen. By the way, that's the way it came to me along with my book. In bright multicolors, it's kind of like the hair on those other things. You can't, number one, they don't have all the feathers. Number two, they don't know anything about the colors. They don't know how it stood up. They don't know anything. But it does have claws at the end of those wings, if those are really the feathers. All right, and I'm not going to argue about whether the feathers are there, whether they're a hoax that the Chinese did. However, I'm just going to say, okay, let's just say Archaeopteryx is real. And we're going to look at what it would take to get from the reptiles to the birds. And this is just an illustration to help you understand some of the differences. You know, this is a pigeon and this is Archaeopteryx. Only reptiles have multiple holes in the skull. And only reptiles would have these claws. And this is the way a reptile skeleton would be. This, the wishbone and the breastbone and all of this, that's the way birds are. So let's just look at it. Let's just talk about a bird that is going to do this. So this is one new one that they found. So they now have two specimens on which they base their entire postulation that reptiles gave birth to birds. That's what it looks like. That's what they draw. And this is a reptile. So we have a bird and we have a reptile. This is a pretty bird. Did that bird come from that reptile we just saw? Well, this is another thing that they gave out that I think is very important. It's not about Archaeopteryx, it's about birds. And what's different about birds, there's some unbelievably amazing differences in birds from any other vertebrate. All right, I could talk about this, but I won't. It's the heart, okay? The circulation works entirely different in a bird than it works in us. And when you look at the respiratory system, it works. What do you think it would be like if you could get oxygen when you breathe in and when you breathe out? Would that be handy? If you could get a flow of oxygen to help to burn your energy, get your energy out of your food as you breathe in and as you breathe out, well, that's the kind of mechanism they have. And as fascinating as that is, I want to focus in on one other thing. Oh, I need to mention the bones. Human bones, for instance, reptile bones, are solid and they're heavy. But they finally found out how to make airplane wings by mimicking a bird, because eagle wings have all sorts of chambers, and they're light. They're very, very light. The largest bird in the world has 4.5 ounces of bones. They are so light because they are filled with air. They have these cross hatchings. So they finally caught on to that in aviation, and that's what's inside the wings of the planes you fly on. So we're not going to talk about that. This is what I want to focus on, and I'll show you that more clearly in a minute. But if you'll look at this, this may be good enough for you to be able to see. I want you to recognize that the way the wing structure works is there's almost no meat on the back of the chicken. Have you noticed that? That's true for turkeys too. There's almost no muscle there. So all the muscles, this is going to look like a movie, Karate Kid. All the muscles for the wings being brought up are on the breast, and all the muscles to bring the wings down are on the breast. That's not the way it is with us. When I lift, you know, I got 100 pounds in each arm, and I'm lifting it up like this. Okay, you know somebody else is doing it. It's my stuntman. Okay, so all of that's on my back, you know, and I have muscles on the front for all of this kind of crushing motion. But everything I do this way, I have back muscles for, but birds don't. So how in the world do they handle that? Because they've got all of the muscles to bring their wings up and down, and they're all stuck on the front, which is why we like the breast of chicken and the breast of turkey, because that's where all the meat is. So let's look at it. What you have right here is a pulley system. So the muscles that are on the front go up past along the wishbone, basically, and they go over a little pulley right there. And they go through this bone and they come down. So basically, you have this little pulley system that's there, so that when they bring their wings back down, all of those muscles are there, but when they go up, all the muscles are here, but it goes over this little thing like that. Now we're going to go back and we're going to look at how that came to be. This is a hummingbird. This is pretty. That's not real. Anyway, so if you look at the muscles there, you see how this is working. You've got them going up, you've got them going down, and the little pulley system, all the muscles are still on the front. Now, reptiles are not that way. So the question is, what do you do with a reptile to go from solid bones, a different respiratory system, a different arterial system and heart, and bones like this that are hollowed out, all right, and you go from scales that give you protection to feathers that would allow you to fly? Do you see the problem we're running into? This is not just finding a fossil that has wings on it, which may be real or they may not. And I'm granting that, I'm just saying, okay, let's just say they're real. But in order to go from a reptile to a bird, you have a lot of other changes you have to make. David Tant used this scripture in his prayer. I actually had it at the end of that same presentation. Faith is the substance of things that you hope for, and it will be the evidence of things you have not seen. That's true for us, we admit it, but it's also true for people who are working with Archaeopteryx. You can have faith and that becomes your evidence. You are just sure that this is the way it happened. So I want to talk about how this would have to happen. Let's just say something, that it was possible for something remarkably different from a bird to be born into a bird's nest, with some of these major changes. Most of us recognize that the mother would probably kick it out of the nest, or it wouldn't be fed, or its siblings would kill it. We know that from animal behavior. Okay, if it's different, if another bird puts their egg in that nest, it is not going to be taken care of by the mother. And certainly if a reptile egg is put in that nest, it's not going to be taken care of by the mother bird. So major changes like that can't happen. They have to be minute, subtle little changes that happen. So here's what you're dealing with with reference to Archaeopteryx. First of all, you would have to have a male and a female that develop into adults so that they could breed, right? And the genetics would have to allow them to breed, because it's not just automatic that male and female can mate. There has to be a real similarity in the DNA and the RNA. And so there's a lot of things that have to change there. You're talking about the biochemistry changing of the molecules that govern reproduction and the enzymes that control the growth of the body. You know, if this part of the embryo is not supposed to stay here and become something, but it's supposed to move across the surface until it gets over here and produce something else, there'd have to be all sorts of signals that would have to be changed. You know, enzymes and hormones and so on that would make that change. It's amazing enough that it happens in humans. If you just look up the embryological development of humans, you have huge pieces on the surface of the embryo that at some point just roll across and migrate over here and become something else. And if you didn't know that, you should know that. Because it's, in my mind, a miracle. I can't explain it any other way. It's just a miracle to watch an embryo develop into a baby. All right, so what you'd have to do is you'd have to have little tiny changes, and I don't know how small they would be. So at what point do you actually turn a scale, which is for an animal that is in a dry environment, to make it turn into a feather? That's the transitional fossil. So maybe there was a lizard out there that God made that had wings. So big deal. That's the way God made it. So it's going to be that way. But it would have the nerves that had to be there. It would have the blood supply that needed to be there, because every feather on a bird has the blood supply for that feather. It has the nerves that control the muscles for each feather. They can move each feather individually. Now, reptiles cannot move a single scale. The scales are there like armor for protection. They have some moderate adjustments that they can make in order to stay cooler, but they can't. Those would not work for feathers. So you are going to have to change all of that. But let's just say the mother doesn't kill it, the siblings don't kill it. Predators, which prey on reptiles, and usually can't get them all the time because of the armor, would now be able to get that reptile as soon as the scales turned into feathers, right? It'd no longer be protected. And now, if it lived in that dry environment as a bird for a while, it probably would not live. The scales are what help save it in terms of water and heat and protection. So if you change the scales into feathers, but let's just say that that happens, and that you have a little baby girl and you have a little baby boy, and they're going to grow up so that they can mate. What else do you have to change? Well, you have to hollow out all the bones. To go from a reptile to a bird, you have to hollow out all the bones. I'm not even sure what the process would be, because you not only have to hollow out the bones, but you would have to hollow out the engineering. Because you can't just put a strut just any place in a wing. It has to be in a very specific place to withstand the power of what it's going to be pushing against. So you'd have to hollow out the bones. And then if you're going to put all of the muscle on the breast, you're going to have to take a normal shoulder joint like ours and put that pulley system in there. So you're going to have to move all the muscles. So do you move all the muscles without the pulley system? No, you can't do that. It wouldn't do anything. So how do you get a change big enough to change all the muscles and put in that pulley system at the same time you are hollowing out the bones and changing the direction of every nerve? You know, every nerve would have to be changed so that you could go out to every feather. And it would have to be changed in the sense that you'd have to have these special muscles at the base of the feathers that allow them to do this. You've seen birds fluff their feathers, right? They puff up in the winter when they're cold, when there's bad weather, and they keep themselves warm. That way, they have control of every single feather. They can change the angle of the planing and everything. Now, all of that would have to be changed. So I see that as massive changes that literally could not happen one by one. Just could not happen one by one. You'd have to have this one and this one and this one to make the change. But really, you would have to have this one, this one, this one, this one, and this one all change at the same time. Or it could not fly. And it's going to have to fly out of harm's way, because it's going to be in an area where things that attack reptiles are going to be there waiting to attack birds. Birds don't have the same protection. So I don't know how to explain it, but if you do not see the faith that is involved in making those changes, so let's just say that you make all the changes that would allow this bird to fly, and that somehow that can actually happen. And it's not a matter of faith. We find it to be a matter of fact. What's the one thing that would have to change that has not yet changed? We've not talked about it. Well, now the reproduction be relatively the same.
Cold-blooded, warm-blooded?
The respiratory system would have to be changed. The circulatory system would have to be changed. The excretory system would have to be changed. They don't work the same. But ultimately, that changed reptile will not know that it can fly. So in some way, you have to rewire all of the nerves and the brain so that that thing knows that it can actually fly. Otherwise, it just runs around as a changed reptile with no protection. And it's going to get zapped. So I don't have the faith to do that. Maybe you do. But I do not have the faith to believe that that can happen. So in terms of these transitional fossils, I just don't think they are there, and I don't think they're there for a reason, because you have to make all of those changes. So to go from one kind to another, those are the kinds of changes that you would have to make, and we don't see them in the fossil record. Those are the transitions that you're looking for. So I'm not going to go through this, but it has to do with Archaeopteryx, and I will be leaving this. This all has to do with a letter that was written from a guy in the British Museum about what they don't have and the speculative nature, the fact that this idea of that change is just not possible. All right. So here's Archaeopteryx. All right. Now, we have one other thing. That's the interpretation, that's the evidence, and so on. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Oh, this is how dinosaurs went down. I'm pretty sure Gary Larson said it. It has to be true. I'm sorry. So what was the promise of paleontology? That the history of life would cease to be a hypothesis. You wouldn't have to make inferences anymore. It would be direct knowledge when the fossils are available. That's what Darwin believed, too. Get more fossils, and you're just going to paint general evolution right through the rocks. And it hasn't happened. So the promise that was there is still outstanding. They've never made good on it. So it's just not been delivered to us. Now I want to talk a little bit about the age of the Earth, okay? I had to write this one too, because there was no quote that did not have evolutionary interpretation wrapped around the evidence for the actual, a literal age of the Earth. Not a relative age, but an absolute dating method. So I wrote, the Earth is older than man's recorded history. So that's my paleontology one, and that's what I'm sticking to. General evolution needs a lot of time. These were not written by creationists, okay? If oak trees and humans share a common ancestor, that ancestor had to live very long ago. All right? For the same reasons about that that reptile turning into a bird. There are a lot of changes that have to be there. So it would take a long time. This was from George Wald, who's a famous biochemist. And he wrote this, and I appreciate the fact that he didn't write it for the reason that I'm reading it to you. But I think he inadvertently made a confession that most of us who believe in believe that God created everything, believe. He said, time is the hero of the plot. Remember I said things have to take a long time? We just read a quote about it. Time is the hero of the plot. The time with which we have to deal with is in the order of 2 billion years. We haven't gotten to that yet. What we regard as impossible on the basis of human experience is meaningless here. So you cannot apply the way you think about human time to any of these things that they talk about in the fossil record. It says, given so much time, the impossible becomes possible, the possible probable, and the probable virtually certain. One only has to wait. Time performs the miracles. Now, there's another whole debate that goes along with this, and that is, Does evolution have any purpose? Can it change its direction because there's a better way to do it? Or is it all just like pool balls? You slam the cue ball into the thing and they're all going to go the direction they're supposed to go physically. And there's no direction to it. You can't predict it. And there was no thought before it of making it all go that way. You just slam it into the entire pack of balls and it's just going to go in different directions. And there have been a lot of people who play pool who have tried to do that and figure out a way to hit the end of the triangle and actually make those end balls go into the pockets. Anyway, occasionally they will, but it's an accident. So time performs the miracles, all right? And this is what they say about us. I think you should be more explicit here in step two, because what it says is, then a miracle occurs. Well, you think that general evolutionists don't have miracles, but they do. You think they don't have faith, but they do. You know, when it comes to a mutation, that's when they invoke a mutation, is when they don't have an answer. It's their miracle. When they talk about punctuated equilibrium, that's their miracle. They are saying, we don't have an answer, but we know it's true. And so here's the way we're going to explain it. And that's their miracle. They cannot establish it. So I want you to think about what has happened with this timing. There was first they would just estimate the relative age of rocks. This time the alternative to special creation, namely the idea of continuity of historical succession, what we would call general evolution, see how much easier it is to understand when I put the right term in front of it, had occurred to a number of thinkers. Some of these recognized any concept of general evolution demanded an Earth of sufficiently great age, so they set out to estimate the age. So they knew it took a long time. And I don't think they recognized how long, because biochemists have said that even 3 to 4 billion years would not be enough to even come close to making the kinds of changes that would have to be made. So you've got scientists disagreeing. Now, this is just a chart of the different things, how people view the biblical genealogies, the significance of Begat, all right? And the main thing here is that there's skipping of generations. What does Begat mean? Is that the birth of a son, or is that the birth of a great-great-grandson, and so on? And there are changes and skipping in the generations. It's not as frequent as people say. So I'm going to skip over that. I really want to get back to the main thing. On this, we're talking about a radioactive decay rate. We're talking about something like uranium, which is radioactive, finally coming back and becoming lead 206, which is not radioactive and it's stable. And why does that happen? Because radioactive materials keep throwing off particles that are high energy. They cannot keep them in the atom, so they sling them out. And then they become something else. And you see all of the things it becomes. Uranium becomes thorium, polonium, uranium, thorium, a different kind of uranium and thorium. And it just goes like that. And then eventually it will decay to the point that the only thing that is there is a stable isotope called lead. So there's three different kinds that we would talk about. If you're talking about uranium to lead or thorium to lead, those are like the hour hand on a clock. That sort of slow movement, that long time thing. If you look at potassium argon, many of you have heard of every one of these things, you're talking about the minute hand. So the hour hand moves really slowly, but you can pretty much watch the seconds tick off on the minute hand, can't you? But carbon-14 is only good up to about 20,000 years. So that's like looking at seconds. And we talked about this in the kids' class this morning. There's radioactive carbon in the atmosphere that you take into your body. So within your body is a reservoir of radioactive carbon, which is disintegrating now. But when you die, you can't replace any of it. Does that make sense? You can't replace any. You're not taking any more into your body through your respiration. And so at that point, it will begin to decay And in 5,000, whatever it is, 700 or so years, you'll go from this amount and half of it will disappear. And then in that same period of time, another half will disappear. So you now have an eighth left. Then another half will disappear. You have a 16th left. You get the idea. So you have this decay curve that looks like this. Theoretically, you will never actually have it all gone. It's kind of like if you go from what's a good city? Oh, Cumming. If you go from Cumming to Atlanta and you go half the distance every day, when will you get there? That's one of them there trick questions that people like to ask. Theoretically, you would never get there because you'd still have a half to go. Okay. But if I get to the drive-through on McDonald's, I'm pretty sure my arm will reach across the rest of that. Okay. Anyway, so that's a decay curve, and I'm going to tell you again that the head of the physics department and I actually did one of those in front of our students in a class with a radioactive substance, I forget what we used, that was very fast decay, and within the course of an hour would decay from the top to the bottom. We put a Geiger counter with it, and we let the students count out the clicks on the Geiger counter at every second, or every, I think we may have done it every 10 seconds. And then they drew the curve that they got. They got a radioactive decay curve. I have no problem with that, okay? The real question is whether there's ever been a case where the radioactive decay has been faster or slower. I mean, if you think that it's, you know, that Timex watch takes a licking and keeps on ticking and it just keeps ticking no matter what you do. Oh, I just went down the roller coaster, you know. I just submerged myself down to 500 meters. I just did this, I did that. Okay, but it keeps ticking at the same rate. That's the concept of radioactive decay. And so the only question would be whether that could change. So I want to go on to that. There's carbon 14. These are the assumptions, and I will very quickly finish this. There are initial conditions. So I see this explained best by thinking about a sparkler. You have a certain amount of material on that piece of metal, right? At the beginning. And so you light it, and then that material begins to spark, and those sparks go out. Okay, that would be like the radioactive material sloughing off part of the atom. And then finally, all of it will be gone, and you will just have the ash left on it. So you have initial conditions, and you have final conditions. And there will, you know, if you measure that, there will be a certain amount of time that you cover, and that will be the rate that decays. You could measure that for a sparkler. I love that picture of the little girl with the sparkler. I did not take it. All right, so initial conditions, final conditions, rate of decay. Well, we saw that on uranium and thorium. They end up going to lead. Their half-life, that thing about half of it disappearing, is very different. So with uranium and thorium, as we know it today, it will give you billions of years. Potassium argon will give you hundreds of thousands, maybe a million. And carbon 14 will go 20,000 years. So what's the significance to you? Well, I'll show you. A lot of people do not like using Robert Gentry. He was at Oak Ridge, and he talked about pleochroic halos. I thought it was a good argument, but there are some new things that have come up, another place where I want to study. However, I understand what he was saying. This is a radioisotope that, polonium is a radioisotope that decays so fast that if the Earth was cooling down slowly, the rock would never form fast enough to put these fingerprints in the rock for polonium. They're called pleochroic halos. That's the hotly debated thing. All right, I don't need it though, and I want to show you why. This is something that was written by Robert Gentry, and that's the one that you can go back and you can look at my slide closer up on your computer, and you can look at that. All right, It's the 164 microsecond half-life, all right? And a lot of people do not accept that particular work. So what you do get in the creationist literature, all right, are all of these dates that are supposed to be wrong. So they'll say that something should be 10,000 years old, but it was marked at 10,000, but it was on a castle that was only 200 years old. It was part of a rock that's 200 years old, that kind of thing. But the one that really caught my attention was pillow lava. Now, recently I saw this program, and Darlene and I were both watching it, where these people got caught on a volcano that was erupting. And the question was, what do you do? Do you run downhill, do you hide behind a rock, or do you run up? You know, which is one of those things that generally I can't make a fast decision if I have lava, molten lava coming at me. But they talked about it, and the best thing to do is get down under a big rock and hope that it goes around you. All right, 8,000 degrees. I think that'll burn through my Nikes, my steel-toed shoes, and everything else. So this is actually a quote from a creationist. I don't remember who put it in. It says, the evidence that radio clocks have actually been deranged is clear from the many dating errors of objects of known age. That's a basic creationist position. We previously mentioned the 6,000-year spread of dates from Jarmo, which is known to have... Which is known to have been inhabited for only 500 years. So they're talking about things like carbon-14 there. Errors with the potassium-argon and uranium methods are equally striking. For example, lava from the Hawaiian and other volcanoes around the world that is known to have flowed within the last 200 years has been dated by the potassium-argon and uranium-lead methods at thousands of millions. I'm not exactly sure why they didn't say billions, but thousands of millions. Surely this demonstrates the assumptions used in dating techniques are not only truly assumptions, but often truly wrong, which actually does refer to real dating, guys. You make an assumption and then it turns out to be wrong, but we could talk about that later. So what's the deal here? They put this out as something to try to debunk the idea that it keeps ticking. It takes a licking, but it keeps on ticking. You can't do anything to change it. There is a constant rate of decay for this. Okay? Well, the dates were different. I went back to the original study, and I looked at what the scientists were planning to do. And of all things, the scientists were making a prediction that the dates would be off radically. That was the purpose of their study, and they showed that it was that way. These creationists have twisted it to say they found out and this proves that all the dating methods are wrong. No, they knew that was what was going to happen. That was the postulate, and that was what they went to study this lava. Because when it goes into the ocean, it forms these pillows. And it hardens over really, really fast. So it's a very different way of forming rock. And they knew that it was going to happen, and they proved that it happens, and the dates were horribly off, thousands of millions of years. Well, now that's what made me think. So what I'm going to say to you is purely my own thinking. I want to know whether these dates are actually something that refer to the time it takes to do something in an absolute way, or whether they tell us more about the process by which rocks form. Because what the scientists have done here is they have said, if this rock forms this way, crusts over very rapidly, the dates will be off by millions or thousands of millions of years. And that's what they proved. So what does that say about the rate of decay? Well, what it says is, since the rate of decay is the thing that you're measuring to give you the date, that you can change the rate of decay under certain circumstances. Now, that's about all I have to offer on it. It's a very complex subject, far more than I would want to deal with here. But you have the initial stuff, you have the final stuff, and you have the rate of decay. And in this one case, at least, I see that the scientists have not only proved that there would be a change in the date, but they have opened the door to the idea that the rate of decay can be changed by the process by which that rock is formed. And that's pretty much it. I just want to say at the end of this how much I appreciate the fact that you all have been so patient. And I know that tonight is the hardest because it deals with things that almost none of you would have dealt with before. There's some in here that have, just like myself. But I want you to understand that at this point, to me, the judge and jury have not brought a verdict yet on some of the things that are offered to us. I am not fully convinced that there is a standard rate of decay for all of these radioactive materials, primarily because of this experiment, which they knew was not going to come out right. And the rest of it can pretty much be addressed by looking at general evolution, chemical evolution, special evolution, and understand that all three of those are theories that must be proven on their own. If you cannot bring life into existence from non-life, then you are believing by faith that general evolution could ever happen. And we need to understand that evidence does not belong to any group or any person. Evidence is used and people interpret, just like in court cases. So you can lay the evidence out, you can select what you want, you can arrange it, and you can interpret it. And then people have to make a judgment about it. And whatever you come up with, if the jury is out and it doesn't prove it one way or the other, both people are believing on faith. So some people believe that O.J. Simpson was guilty, and some people believe that he was not guilty. And we sort of have a hung jury there in our population. I mean, people looked at the same evidence, didn't they? Looked at the same glove. They looked at all the same evidence, and people reasoned through the evidence along with the lawyers, and half of the country practically believes that he was not guilty, and the others believe that he was. We have lots of court cases like that that demonstrate that evidence cannot automatically be used for one interpretation, and that's pretty much what we covered this week. I pray God will bless this congregation abundantly. I go across the country and I do this stuff, and it's kind of amazing what I find, because where I don't know that there's anybody, all of a sudden I find a bunch of Christians worshiping together, even in small groups like 10 people or 7 people or 700 people. People who are dedicated to understanding that they cannot get to heaven alone because they sin. They are not holier than anybody else. They are the sinners who have taken advantage of God's grace. That's the big difference. And we cannot forget that. Personally, we cannot forget that. We are not here as church members and Christians because we are better than anybody. We are the ones who have admitted that we do not deserve heaven, and yet God gave us that opportunity. So keep that in your mind. I don't even know how to say goodbye to you guys. Love you. I wish you the best. If we can help you in obedience to the Lord, just come forward while we stand and sing.